You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 28th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, fresh off his attendance for arguments to preserve Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act at the Supreme Court, Ari Berman of The Nation will be joining us. Also on the program today, Jack Lew, confirmed as our next Treasury Secretary. Still, I think, on the payroll of Citibank. He got a severance package, but with a special bonus if he went back into federal government service. Why not? That is true. It is technically true. Yes, actually it is. Oh, yes. Also, Bob Woodward continuing on his attempt to make me look even smarter in retrospect. But also, in addition, in this latest thing where he claimed he was threatened by an economist, he inadvertently reveals, or I should say, confirms the argument that we've been making on this program and has been made in other quarters, that President Obama has been seeking to trade away Social Security or Medicare benefits for a long time. All that will come up in the program. Bradley Manning speaks at his hearing. Bank profits apparently were totally taxpayer subsidized. In other words, you guys just gave money to the banks, which just so they could have a profit. Basically, that's it. And I'm not talking through the banking system, but rather the taxing system. We will get to Ari Berman in a moment. We recorded him earlier this morning, actually just moments ago. However, I just got this email from listener G, let's call him. As a longtime listener and a member of the Majority Report, I'm afraid I've had to cancel my membership. As a DOD civil servant, I am preparing for a furlough. This is a function of the sequester. So, at the very least, here at the Majority Report, we are feeling it already. As a DOD civil servant, I'm preparing for furlough. That will mean a 20% cut in pay for the rest of the year. $10 a month is a small amount of money. However, my family and I have been living paycheck to paycheck. 20% is way more than any discretionary funds I may have had. Rest assured, I will rejoin when I'm able. In the meantime, maybe you can talk more about what these Tea Party reps are doing in an attempt to kill our social programs and U.S. Postal Service. Indeed, I will. And, I haven't gotten back to you yet. We just got this email. But we will work something out. You will not lose your membership because of the elite in this country that want to impose austerity because of their crazed fetish. And to be fair to them, their incredible desire to not pay essentially the dues they owe to society based upon what they've been able to garner from our society. And with that said, folks, if you are not, if you think in some way that you're not going to be affected by the sequester, you can become a member today at Majority FM. Help out those folks who are not able to become members so that you can continue to support this program. It's majority.fm. Become a member. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will play that interview I just did moments ago with Ari Berman from The Nation. Back on the Majority Report. My name is Sam Cedar on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Ari Berman, who you will recall, audience, previewed yesterday's argument in front of the Supreme Court as to the need, I guess, or the constitutionality, I guess, of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires preclearance for 9 states and then about a half dozen other counties around the country if they make any voting law changes to have those pre-cleared by the Department of Justice because of past racial discrimination. Ari, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me back.
Ari, you were in the Supreme Court yesterday. Now, my understanding is you were not making the arguments in front of the Supreme Court.
No, but I might have done a better job than Donald Verrilli, the Solicitor General, if I had been.
You know, I want to get to Verrilli in a little bit because I feel like I've had this exact conversation before about Verrilli, and I think it was in the Affordable Care Act and maybe two other cases in the past. Be that as it may, tell me what – now, we know obviously there's some hostility from – a case, I guess, about 5 years ago in front of the Supreme Court regarding the Voting Rights Act. What did you hear from the justices?
So it's important to remember Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act has been upheld 4 times by the court, in 1966, in 1973, in 1980, and 1999. Then it came before the court again in 2009, and the court upheld it, but they basically said we have serious constitutional questions about this law because it treats some states differently than others, and it imposes current burdens that must be justified by current needs, in the words of John Roberts. So they decided to essentially rehear a challenge to Section 5 from Alabama yesterday.
Okay, and, hold on. Let me say, go back to what you just said about Justice Roberts, because I want people to understand what that means. The formula for Section 5 which requires preclearance, was based on data back in the 60s, correct?
Yeah, it was based on two things. Number one, did states have voter turnout in the presidential election of 1964 below 50%? Did they have something like a literacy test on the books that was used to suppress voters? This data was then updated in 1968 and 1972, and the Voting Rights Act was subsequently expanded in 1975 to cover places that discriminate against what's called language minority groups, so Hispanics, for example, or Native Americans, and that covered new places like California and New York and Arizona and Texas. But essentially, Roberts's main beef with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is twofold. Number one, he doesn't like the fact that it treats some states differently than others, although there's very good data that shows that the states covered by Section 5 account for almost all of the discrimination that is ongoing in this country, so that the coverage formula is justified, but nonetheless, Roberts doesn't like the justification for it. And the second thing that he's concerned about is the infringement on state sovereignty. The idea that this was Section 5 was an extraordinary measure taken by the Congress to try to stop what had been essentially 95 years of voter suppression in response to the 15th Amendment of 1870. And Roberts' feeling is, yes, it was justified in 1965, but it's not justified any longer, that voter suppression isn't a problem like it was in 1965, and the remedy is not justified. And even if voter suppression is a problem, that it's a problem across the country, not just in the South. And that seems to be something that Anthony Kennedy is also worried about. Now, I don't think Kennedy phrases it quite as bluntly as Roberts does, but I think they're basically singing the same song on this one.
All right. So wait a second. So let's just go back, because at one point you had Justice Roberts questioning Solicitor General Verrilli, and posing a series of questions that one of his crack law clerks obviously came up with some factoids to the effect of which state has the greatest disparity in registration between white and African American. Verrilli says, I don't know that. And Robert says, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
I don't know if he said it in that way, but he's clearly here really proud of himself. And he,
John Roberts sounds almost like your imitation of him, so it's pretty similar.
And he said, do you know which state has the worst ratio of white voter turnout to African-American voter turnout? Verrilli, I do not. Massachusetts!
Yeah.
And so the idea—
John Roberts really has a thing against Massachusetts. Well, I don't know if it's from his time at Harvard or what.
But, well, I mean, the point being that he's trying to make here is that Mississippi— is actually more progressive in terms of embracing African American voters than Massachusetts, is his argument. Is that, I mean,
well, there's absolutely no validity to that argument. I mean, I don't know why Verrilli didn't say this, but Massachusetts has a black governor, Deval Patrick, who's been reelected. A black candidate has never been elected nationwide in Mississippi. So clearly there is a very big difference between Massachusetts and Mississippi when it comes to race. The other thing is that if you look at violations of other portions of the Voting Rights Act, states that are covered by Section 5 account for about a quarter of the U.S. population, but they provide nearly 80% of successful lawsuits in other parts of the Voting Rights Act. So that just goes to show you that even with Section 5 on the books, discrimination is still concentrated in these places that are covered by Section 5. Texas, Virginia, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, these places are repeat offenders. Every single election cycle, they have a problem. They had major problems in 2012. That's why the Justice Department blocked laws in places like Texas, Florida, and South Carolina successfully in 2012. Under Section 5. So this whole weird theoretical discussion that the court had about the sovereignty of states was totally divorced from the reality of voter suppression, both in this election and in previous elections.
All right. No, wait. I don't want to conflate that argument, because there seems to have multiple arguments that they're attacking the validity of Section 5. One is that the data has not been updated, and which in a specific sense may be the case. However, you have been able to counter, as far as I can tell, far more successfully than Solicitor General Varelli, that there's, well, you can't, you could look at very specific measures of that that we used at that time, but there is another set of measures which also indicate that there's a problem, and that is their record of keep trying to pass laws that other courts have found discriminate prevent African Americans from voting, or in some way provide at least a prima facie, if not an actually adjudicated case, of racial discrimination in terms of setting up voting laws. So that's sort of the argument number one, which seems to be fairly easily dismissed, because there is a, you know, I can say, like, well, we chose these people on one set of way of measuring whether or not the state is racist, for, you know, to just paint a broad brush, but at least in terms of their voting practices. And yes, they may have in some way achieved success in that data set. However, because essentially finding ways of disenfranchising African Americans or other racial groups from voting is an ever-evolving business. It's sort of like, you know, innovating new financial products in some way. Right? I mean,
And I mean, conservatives now have sort of taken like a Wall Street approach to voter suppression. I mean, they're increasingly chopping up these synthetic security forms of voter suppression that are harder and harder to block and to stop. And we saw that in the last election with all the different forms, whether it was voter ID laws or cutbacks in early voting or cutbacks in voter registration or proof of citizenship to register to vote or voter purges. And then there was the whole issue of redistricting. So, I mean, the thing is, if you look at what's happened since the 2010 election, six of those nine fully covered states under Section 5 passed new voting restrictions. So two-thirds of them passed new voting restrictions, which clearly show that they're still trying to suppress the vote. Only one-third of the states that aren't covered by Section 5 did the same. So does Section 5 catch all of the discriminators? No, absolutely not. It's never caught all of the discriminators. Does it catch the bulk of them? Yes, it still catches the worst of the worst actors. Does the spread of voter suppression mean that we should get rid of the most important tool to stop voter suppression? Now, that's kind of a counterintuitive argument. It's one lawyer in my piece in The Nation, who's from North Carolina, Anita Earle, said it's a unique concept to say that if you're not catching everyone, you can't catch anybody. And that's essentially the argument that the court seems to be accepting, that, you know, every state needs to be subject to the same weak remedy rather than some states being subject to a stronger remedy than others.
Well, now you see, that's the weird thing, is that obviously the court has upheld the existence of the Voting Rights Act. So to find that the in Section 5, to find that it's no longer constitutional, they must argue that somehow it's being applied unfairly to these states, right? I mean, and so
they're not arguing that. No. They're not. The court is not arguing that. They're not arguing that Section 5 is being abused. They are arguing that the states subject to Section 5 should no longer be subject to it, that either you have to draw a new formula based on current data, which is impossible to do. Congress looked at this in 2006 and couldn't do it, because if you simply base it, for example, on voter registration metrics in the past three elections, which is what conservatives from the South opposed, the only state you cover is Hawaii, which has no history of racial discrimination in voting. So, I mean, you have to figure out what is a better formula, and there is no better formula, and the Supreme Court is not proposing another formula, and Congress is not considering a different formula. So then the question is, well, can you just do this nationwide? No. If you do it nationwide, if you extend Section 5 nationwide, it'll be ruled unconstitutional by the court because it's not, quote unquote, congruent and proportional, because that's the test under which Section 5 has been upheld. So you're really left essentially with, you either have Section 5 as it is now, or you have no Section 5. I don't really think there's any in between here.
Now, did the court address the fact that any jurisdiction under Section 5 can actually there is an administrative process? Is it an administrative process or a judicial process in which they can petition to be released from Section 5 because they have evidence that the problem that Section 5 was designed to remedy is no longer in play?
Yeah, I mean, places with a clean record for the past 10 years can bail out. So, for example, there's some townships in New Hampshire that are covered, and they're bailing out because New Hampshire's not a problem.
Was this
anymore.
Raised? I mean, this seems to me to address exactly the problem that this, Kennedy.
You know, it's fascinating. The bailout didn't come up in this. It came up in 2009 because the Supreme Court allowed the jurisdiction in Texas that was challenging the constitutionality of Section 5 to bail out. But they didn't deal with bailout here precisely because Shelby County, the county in Alabama that's challenging the law, can't bail out because they were the subject of an objection in 2008 from the Justice Department that I detail in my Nation piece. So they can't bail out, and so bailout wasn't really a part of it. I think the Justice Department was hoping that they could push the bailout option before the court. But the justices really didn't seem interested in entertaining this question. I think they took this case again after hearing a similar case in 2009 precisely because they wanted to decide the constitutionality of this. They didn't want to punt any longer. And five justices on the court, I think, have made up their mind that this thing should go.
I mean, I agree with that.
Are they prepared for the legal blowback? Are they prepared for the political blowback? Will they say that? I don't know. But clearly, ideologically, five justices on the court want Section 5 to go.
I mean, I don't know how, though, Varelli, there seems to be plenty of opportunities to have brought up the notion of the bailout because of bailing out of Section 5, because that is also evidence as to whether or not it should be applied to those jurisdictions, right? I mean,
well, it's covered extensively in the briefs. It just didn't come out in the oral arguments. The oral arguments are a very herky-jerky affair. Listen, the justices, they interrupt the lawyers within about 30 seconds. There's weird banter going on. There's like hypothetical discussions. Like the whole thing just happens so quickly that I'm sure there's always points that they want to make that don't get made.
Right.
And I think they felt for whatever reason that the bailout thing was not their best argument. Even though they made the argument in the briefs, the oral arguments, it just didn't seem to be a focus of the conversation, and I don't know. I didn't talk to Don Verrilli afterwards, so I don't know why he didn't say that. I know that after Verrilli spoke, Debo Adegbole of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund did a very good job, but he only had 10 minutes,
right.
And there was a lot that he had to say in the 10 minutes to try essentially to salvage the mess that Verrilli had made in his first 20 minutes.
Now, full disclosure, I went to college with Debo, and saw him recently at a function, and we may have him on the program in the coming weeks to talk about this. But was he questioned at all, or did he just get to say his piece? And that's when they basically said, "Well, you know, I mean, what happened during his back and forth?" Because all the transcripts that I've seen that have been highlighted have been with Verrilli.
I mean, Debo tried to bring in more contemporary instances of discrimination. He tried to point out that the formula was working, that discrimination was localized in the Section 5 states, that there was still an ongoing need for this. I mean, at this point, the case had already been going on for about 50 minutes. And so most of the major arguments were already going on earlier. You already had, for example, Justice Kennedy comparing the Voting Rights Act to the Marshall Plan and essentially saying times have changed, like as if, you know, we had just rebuilt post-war Germany and the job was done. And so you kind of got a sense of where the justices were leaning. Obviously, Scalia made that infamous comment about a perpetuation of racial entitlement. You had John Roberts.
I want to talk about that perpetuation of racial entitlement, and also sort of the what I think is just sort of stunning. I mean, you know, we've heard ad nauseum from the right wing in this country, and maybe not so much as of late, because they control the court now in such an explicit manner, but that the idea of activist judges overturning what the duly elected representatives have voted for was sort of turned on its head by Scalia somewhere around the time that he said that racial perpetuation of racial entitlement. Well, first off, He says there's something out there that has been written about, that I've read about, you know, the perpetuation of racial entitlement. First off, when I Google it, the only phrase time I can see that phrase is when he's used it in the past, back in like 2007, I think, with the last version of this case, or 2006, around the time that this was reinstated reauthorized. Tell us about what that term supposedly means, at least to Scalia.
I think he got it from George Wallace.
Oh, nice.
No, I mean, you know what? I think in general what Scalia's point was is that it's politically radioactive for politicians to vote against the Voting Rights Act. He said at one point, you know, even look at the name, the Voting Rights Act. Who could vote against that? And he was basically saying that we're in a position where black voters have sufficient power because the Voting Rights Act, in his words, mandates black districts, which it doesn't mandate black districts unless you can logistically draw them based on the population. But nonetheless, he was basically saying that the Voting Rights Act has created a situation where black power is such that it's politically radioactive to vote against the Voting Rights Act, and thus it leads to a perpetuation of racial entitlement. Now, it's hard for me to even make the argument because not only do I not agree with the argument, but I don't even totally understand it. But I think that's nonetheless what he was trying to argue. Now, does Justice Kennedy agree with Scalia on that? No, probably not. I mean, but does Justice Kennedy, in the end, is he prepared to sign an opinion with Scalia getting rid of the Voting Rights Act? I mean, that's all that really matters, right? I mean, the quote has been blown out of proportion, but the disturbing thing is that there's five justices on the court who basically believe that we've reached such a place where the remedies of the Voting Rights Act aren't relevant. And to say that, you basically have to think that racism and voter suppression are no longer problems in American society. And it's just very hard, based on the last election, to come to that conclusion.
And just when you step back, though, the idea that you have had this this act reauthorized, what is it now, five times, the idea that it was reauthorized with sort of overwhelming majorities in the House and the Senate becomes the fulcrum to justify overturning it. I mean, this is, you know, like the idea, yes, I agree. We knew Scalia where he was from the very beginning. But it seems to me that Kennedy is signing off on the idea that if society has agreed that this is so necessary, but that their elected representatives have virtually no choice but to vote for it, even though it's unconstitutional at this point. I mean, to argue that this has reached that level of, I mean, there, in some respects, he's like, the only analogy that I could draw here is that he's like almost analogizing it to slavery, right? I mean, the idea that this is so toxic to vote for. Now, of course, you could have voted against the authorization for war, and that was an extremely toxic vote to take, you know, when we were heading to Iraq, to think that that could be a justification as to why the court must step in and prevent this is just, it seems bizarre to me. I mean, am I reading too much into that?
Well, I think Scalia in general has just become very dismissive of like any congressional legislation that was passed after like 1778. And I think the question is, you know, not just the political support for the Voting Rights Act, which I think is a reason not to strike it down, simply because there clearly is a bipartisan consensus for this law in Congress. Congress didn't just pass it once, it's subsequently gone back and reauthorized it four times and held extensive hearings each time. So faced with the prospect of not renewing it, Congress has come to the conclusion that it should be renewed, not just based on the politics, but based on a very thorough evidentiary record. But I think it raises a broader question of what can Congress do? What can America do to remedy historic instances of discrimination? Throughout our history, what can we do to enforce the amendments that are in the Constitution that have often been ignored, principally the 15th Amendment? And if the court strikes these things down, where does it stop? I mean, they're about to get rid of affirmative action too. So you've just gotten rid of the heart and soul of the Voting Rights Act and affirmative action. So
right, I don't know how you maintain affirmative action if you see the capacity to have some type of non-racially discriminatory voting to be a racial entitlement. I don't see how you uphold any aspect of affirmative action. That's for sure.
Well, I think the fate of affirmative action is even more in doubt than Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act right now, based on the arguments before the court. So the court, basically, the question is, where are they going to stop? Are they just going to keep striking down every single law that deals with discrimination in one form or another, no matter what Congress has done, no matter what the previous amendments say? And so I think we're on a very slippery slope here. And this decision is not just going to be a one-off decision. I think it's going to embolden more radical decision by the court in the future. And I think so, both from a practical standpoint in terms of the importance of the Voting Rights Act, but also just from a legal standpoint in terms of the power that Congress should have, this decision, I think, is going to raise a lot of disturbing questions.
All right. Now, I know you got to go soon. Let me just ask you one or two more questions here. This whole thing about the sovereign states that at one point, I think Kennedy said something to the effect of is it better off doing that? Is Alabama, if Alabama wants to have monuments to the heroes of the civil rights movement, if it wants to acknowledge the wrongs of its past, is it better off doing that if it's its own independent sovereign, or if it's under the trusteeship of the United States government? What the frick is he talking about here?
Well, that was such a bizarre comment, because Alabama, quote unquote, is under the trusteeship of the federal government, according to Kennedy, and it's passed and done monuments all over the place to the civil rights movement. I mean, it's not like Alabama hasn't acknowledged its history. The problem is, as Justice Breyer said during the hearings, we fought a civil war. It was about states. Certain states were trying to get out of the Union so they could protect slavery. Those are the same states, it just so happens, that are still trying to suppress their growing minority vote populations today. And so, of course, this is about differences between states, because it was only some states that seceded from the Union. I mean, so it's almost as if the Civil War had never happened in terms of these justices' understanding of history. It's almost like the civil rights movement ended in 1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, as opposed to continuing for nearly 50 years to have to fight on a constant basis to uphold the promise of the Voting Rights Act and to get rid of voter suppression. So I think this is a very theoretical principle for people like Justice Kennedy, this idea of sort of a federalism. This is something that really happened under Rehnquist, this whole notion of a federalism revolution. And so it seemed to me like we were having a very theoretical discussion.
All right, what is he talking about here? The trusteeship. I mean, I'm searching around here for my Constitution, but it's Article. It's the 15th Amendment says very explicitly that the federal government has the right to make sure that there's no discrimination that's going on in the context of voting, and presumably, to the extent that the states have certain rights that come in maybe the 14th Amendment or I think the 10th Amendment, they are the 15th Amendment. It comes after those amendments. I've signed contracts that have been amended. You put the amendment on to supersede or trump essentially the amendments or the contract that came before it. I mean, that's the definition of an amendment, right? I mean, that's why you do an amendment. It's because we want to add this or we want to modify something that we had said earlier.
And exactly. I mean, and the whole purpose of the 15th Amendment was that there was no affirmative right to vote, or and there was no protection based on, you know, race, color, or previous condition of servitude to vote in the United States before the passage of the 15th Amendment in 1870. And there was no enforcement mechanism for the 15th Amendment until the passage of the Voting Rights Act. I mean, the Voting Rights Act essentially was passed to enforce something that had been passed nearly 100 years earlier. And I should just add, it's not like federal troops are occupying Alabama. I mean, all Alabama has to do is submit it's voting changes to the federal government. If there's no problem, DOJ or the courts will sign off on these changes, and it won't be a big deal. It doesn't cost that much money. It doesn't take that long of a time. There's only problems if they start discriminating. So it's funny, John Roberts famously said the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Well, I could say the same thing to Alabama. You want to be free from these burdens? Well, then just stop discriminating and you will be. But the problem is that places like Alabama are still discriminating, so they're still subject to Section 5.
And I think just sort of theorizing and conceptually perceiving the idea that, well, you're making them a trustee of the year, like as if, like, you're being too in loci parentis of this state. It's just, this is what the Constitution says. You know, this is not, it really is stunning, their reaction. So, all right, give me one more moment here. The blowback, okay? We know that at least much of turnout in 2012 has been or some elements of turnout of 2012 when there was a lot of concern about voter ID, all types of restrictions on voting, that there was an increase in turnout, particularly amongst African-Americans from where it was anticipated, because it energized people that there was an attack on their voting rights. Do you think the same thing could happen here with Section 5, so much so that it will force, at the very least, Congress to, okay, you said basically threw it back to us, we're going to now make some election reforms, either in the form of, in the context of making sure that there's racial equality, or just some national reforms that are well needed so that you can't gerrymander the way that's been going on. You can't, you know, all lines – you can't have longer lines for African-Americans than, you know, in some districts, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I would say two things about it. Number one, I think it's a very dubious proposition to imagine that Congress can pass any sort of election reform, let alone the type of election reform that would even come close to replacing Section 5. These guys can't even prevent the government from running out of money or from shutting down right now. So the idea that they're going to somehow reach bipartisan agreement on election reform, I think, is pretty difficult. If they're going to do it, they're certainly going to have to do it after 2014, when there's perhaps a different composition of the Congress. The second thing is, the blowback against voter suppression in 2012 was a very unique situation. It was the result of courts blocking a lot of these laws. It was the result of an incredibly organized presidential campaign and the Obama campaign that is not likely to be recreated anytime soon in terms of its the amount of attention they dealt to organizing. And there's the result of a tremendous organizing effort in the Black, Hispanic, Asian, other minority groups that is difficult to replicate. So for all these reasons, I don't think we could just count on a backlash against voter suppression somehow ameliorating the impact of losing Section 5. If people I talk to who are from these Section 5 states, like Texas, like Virginia, like Alabama, they say the gains that have been made in terms of things like voter registration, Black candidates in office, turnout, those are because of the protections of Section 5. If you get rid of Section 5, it's going to be harder for minority voters to get elected and to participate in the electoral process. And these are states where they're already, in some cases, very red. And so they're likely to get more red, and there's likely to be more voter suppression efforts. And it's just going to be very, very difficult to kind of create the kind of legal or grassroots mobilization that could counter losing Section 5. So, I mean, it's possible some good could come out of this, but I don't think we should fool ourselves. I mean, people who said, well, the Citizens United decision is going to lead to some unprecedented new era of campaign finance reform. Yeah. Well, that hasn't happened at all.
Right.
And so I don't think we should think that the same thing is going to happen in voting rights either.
Ari, when will we know the decision from the Supreme Court?
End of June, probably the last day. So what will happen is they'll issue decisions probably on voting rights, affirmative action, and both gay marriage cases, and then they'll go retreat to the Greek Isles for 3 months while everyone screams in fury.
Sounds like a nice gig if you can get it. Ari Berman, of The Nation magazine. Thank you so much for staying with us longer than I know that you can. I know you're very busy today. And
anything for you, Sam.
You're very sweet, Ari. Next time you're in that Supreme Court, dude, when you hear Varelli not making those arguments, I think my vote is you make them. You just get up and you make them.
Yelling.
Think about it. All right. Ari Berman, folks. Well, I don't know if Ari is going to actually end up doing that, but... But if he does, folks, you know why he's doing it. The idea started right here. All right, we're going to head into the continuation of our program and say goodbye to those people who have not become members of the Majority Report. You can also support this show by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link, which you can find at majority.fm/support-the-show. You simply click on that link, you bookmark it, you make all of your purchases that you make anyways from Amazon, you will see no difference. We will see a not insignificant kickback. Also, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a 10% discount code MAJORITY. You can buy the Majority FM blend there if you're so inclined. Coming up, we're going to talk about Bob Woodward's really malleable definition of the word threat, and also what the exchange in which he was supposedly threatened tells us about what the Obama administration hoped to gain in terms of a grand bargain, what they were willing to put on the table, what they were looking to put on the table. Also on the program, what's the best way to alert the police that someone might be a shoplifter? You're going to have to tune into the better half to find out. Also on the program, Bradley Manning, as we speak, is speaking in court. He has pled guilty to some charges, not to others. And we will talk about the revelations that are coming out as we speak. Also, Jack Lew confirmed. And we'll talk about that wonderful little bonus he was given by Citibank for going back into government. Talk about, I don't want to mix metaphors here, but greasing the wheels for the revolving door. I don't know if revolving doors have wheels, but the number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. If you've been complaining about me on YouTube as you're watching this show live, please, by all means, call in. If you're a libertarian who wants to explain why you believe the UN is coming for us, please do. This is your opportunity. And, of course, all of our lines are open. Our East Coast line, 646-257-3920. West Coast, 646-257-3920. And our conservative libertarian lines, 646-257-3920 for conservatives and libertarians. You, of course, can IM the show at Majority FM. We got to take a break. We will be right back with more.